How do you build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects, candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
Welcome back to my conversation with Mike Burns. We've been talking about the culture-building lessons that he learned as an elite lacrosse player at North Carolina and as a Navy SEAL. Mike, I want to get into your post-military life, after you left the SEALs and you joined Sway Ventures. Like, what is it about Sway Ventures that made you say, you know, this is something I really want to do next?
So I don't know how much, you know, you've read about SkillBridge, but SkillBridge is this program through the Department of Defense that allows people to work the last 6 months of their active duty time at a company free of charge to the company. And it's basically an exchange of knowledge and real world experience in the hopes that you can get hired and get that stuff on your resume and get hired once your separation date comes. Mm-hmm. That's what I did with Sway Ventures. And throughout my 6 months here, I just loved the culture that they had. I loved the autonomy that they give the employees here and kind of the freedom to explore things as they see fit. That was really important to me because in the Navy, I had the opportunity to do the same with good leaders. I'll caveat that with good leaders. The good leaders gave me the freedom and flexibility. And, you know, I earned that over time. Somebody taught me early on the three C's, competency plus character equals credibility. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had credibility with my superiors and they gave me the freedom and autonomy to kind of run things to ground on my own. And they knew that what I was reporting back to them was true and accurate and a good assessment. At Sway, I felt the same thing throughout my free 6 months of working here and thought that it was a place that, you know, I definitely wanted to work.
And so what is your role there? What do you do?
So right now I'm an associate here and I work across the platform in multiple different functions. We're a smaller VC fund, so, you know, less employees than the behemoths out there. Mm-hmm. And I work on the investment team, do some investor relations stuff, do some strategy stuff with some of our portfolio companies. Basically, try to be a jack of all trades, which I like.
And so you come out of this may sound like a funny question, but you come out of this hyper exciting, at least it looks like from the outside, hyper exciting, you know, macho, you know, SEAL experience. You're in combat, you're doing intense things, and now you're sitting at a desk analyzing investment opportunities. So how do you make that kind of adjustment?
To be honest, it was tough. It's no job will ever be as fun as being in the SEAL teams. And it's not even really a job. It's kind of going to work and hanging out with your best friends every day. Granted, there's a lot of stuff that is work, but it just doesn't seem like it at the time. The adjustment was kind of hard, but as I alluded to earlier, you know, priorities change and sometimes you have to move on to other things to, mm-hmm. you know, accommodate different things in your life. So
when you think about, you know, you've had this very unique experience of being in the SEALs. And so I'm curious about, I mean, that's such a unique experience and it has to shape in significant ways the way you look at the world and what you bring into being a father, a husband, a worker in your new company. What are some of the things you think you take from the SEAL principles and bring them into your post-SEAL life?
The biggest one is stress management. It's maybe one of the biggest things that you're taught to deal with throughout your time in BUDS, SQT, in the SEAL teams, and you get better at it over time as you are exposed to different stressors. Everything you do in BUDS, there's a test that follows it. And it's amazing to see when you're on the other side of things as an instructor or somebody on the other side, what stress does to guys that are taking these tests that are, you've seen them complete this tens to hundreds of times. And then you throw in the word test and you have some people watching and some guys fold and can't deal with it. But like I said, you know, you're exposed to that throughout all of BUDS and SQT and you get better at it over time. And the stress management piece is so big. And as I relate that to outside of the SEAL teams, things just don't stress me out as much anymore. And I'm super thankful for that. And when I see people, you know, whether I work with them or at home or out in town, I just have to think to myself, like, why are you so stressed about that? You just have to take a step back and think about how you're going to solve it and what the solution is versus, oh my God, I have this crazy big problem. Okay, take a step back and solve it. And that's what, you know, we learn to do in the SEAL teams. And I think that most SEALs are really effective at doing so.
Interesting. So, you know, one of the things I'm always curious about with anybody is that I always think that as we go through life, if we're thoughtful and reflective, there are, you know, you mentioned that there are things that, that we know now that we wish we knew before and that we're now smarter. And when I used to run our first company and we were interviewing people, I would always like to ask that kind of a question. If whether you're a receptionist or a salesperson or a consultant or whatever, if I'm the receptionist and I'm interviewing a receptionist, I'll often ask something like, okay, you've been a receptionist for years. There are things you know now about what it takes to be a great receptionist that you didn't know when you started. Or maybe said another way, if you were talking to somebody who was thinking about becoming a receptionist, I know that's kind of a mundane example, but if you were thinking about becoming a receptionist, what advice would you give to somebody that, you know, you wish somebody gave to you? So if I take that to where you are now, if you were giving advice to somebody who was perhaps either, we'll take this in two different directions. First, somebody was thinking about going into the Navy and perhaps going into the SEAL program or BUDS, and or maybe not, but they were entering military life and you were giving them your top one or two pieces of advice that you wish somebody had given you back then. What's the top advice you'd give them?
My top piece of advice is look out for your people. You know, especially in the SEAL teams, reputation is everything. And it literally, people start forming, you know, their decision of you day one. And every single action that you have is going to matter down the road. I mean, we sit around sometimes and talk about guys that we went through Hell Week with. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't sleep from Sunday to Friday, aside from two-hour naps. It's on the go the whole time. You don't stop. But how people act during that time and the 3 weeks prior to that is basically the foundation of how people are going to look at them and think of them for the rest of their career. Mm-hmm. I know guys that I went through Hell Week with that did not perform well at all, and they could be the best SEAL down the road and completely pull a 180, and they're the whole time just trying to dig themselves out of that hole that they dug back in day one or week three, whatever it may be. With that being said, and how that relates to, you know, look out for your people. If you're a great guy and you're giving it all you've got, and no matter what, you're looking to look out for your teammates, nobody can fault that. And nobody can say that you're a bad person or selfish. And, you know, that's another word that you never want to be labeled in the SEAL teams, because it really is all looking out for your buddies.
And so let's expand that beyond. So forget that it's the military. I'm a youngster, 18, 19 years old. I'm thinking about going to college. I'm not even sure what I'm going to do next. And I meet Mike Burns. And boy, I look up to that guy. He's done so much with his life already at 33 years old. And I say to that Mike Burns, Mike, you know, what do you wish you knew when you were my age? What's your answer to that question?
You know, I would say one thing that I've realized is if I want something, I have to maybe sacrifice something else. So when I decided to get into the SEAL teams, I basically gave up a whole summer of hanging out with my friends and partying with my friends when I was 24. Yeah, I think I was 23 or 24, moved in with my grandma in Long Beach Island, New Jersey, and worked out every day in her garage. And I thought to myself, like, you know, this is my sacrifice I have to make. And if I'm not all the way in, then I'm out. Mm-hmm. And that's the piece of advice I would give to other youngsters. Like, if you want something, it sounds so much easier, you know, said than done. But if you want something, you have to make a sacrifice. And whether that's time or, you know, lifestyle choice, things just don't happen. You have to work. You know, going back to college, I was kind of naive and I thought that, like, oh yeah, I'm going to a great school and I'm going to play a sport and people are going to look highly upon that when I get out and see my resume that I was the captain of the lacrosse team. And it's just not true. Like, you have to continue working and continue improving yourself and always getting better, you can't just rest on your laurels and expect things to happen. You got to go out and make them happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to tie this back to, if I think about what you've said, I would say if I were to distill, my brain tries to distill things to their essence. And if I were to distill almost everything that you've said to its essence, it would be, and you can tell me if I'm right about this, it would be the importance of leaders, anybody, but leaders especially, taking care of their people, being servant leaders, as you called it, and as the term is, that you got to take care of your people and not worry so much about yourself. So if I'm going into a company, we're into civilian life now, and certainly I would want to work in a company that had that kind of a culture. How would I, if I was a candidate, how would I assess the culture of an organization from that perspective and know, is this the kind of place that I'm going to want to work? How do you figure out what the culture is, do you think? I know you're new at this, especially since you just got out of the Navy, but how would somebody determine that? I mean, clearly being in a place that is a good cultural fit for you, and you know, we talk a lot in our company about, you know, cultural fit doesn't mean good or bad. It's just that it's fit. Some people would be a good fit in this culture and they wouldn't be a good fit in a different culture. So if you're trying to assess the culture of an organization, you've learned how important the culture is, how do you figure that out?
It's a really tough thing, right? People are trying to solve for this, but I think my way of doing so would be getting a pulse on all the employees and how happy they were with their superiors and working at their job, and if they felt like they could trust their superiors and if they thought they could be trusted as well. Because it's a mutual thing, and it's tough, right? Because like, if you want to have great culture, I don't think you can please everybody, especially in the civilian world. In the military, you don't have to worry about pleasing others. Rules are rules. And like you said before, you do as I say can be something that you say. But in the civilian world, people want different things and everyone's different. And it's not as kind of, I don't know if myopic is the right word, but like you know, singularly focused on one type of individual. So you can't please everybody. And trying to find that balance is a really, really tough thing. And, you know, I think it's important for me anyway to get a pulse of how everyone at the company feels and then just see if there's that mutual trust. Mm-hmm. How you do that is tough and different for everybody.
Yeah. It's an interesting point you're making. I hadn't really thought of it from that perspective, that in the military, you have a very clear objective. And everybody, again, they don't have a lot of choice. They're on the team. Whether they've enlisted or gotten drafted or whatever, they're there. They don't have any choice. And we are singularly focused on this is what the objective is. Whereas when you think about in a civilian environment, they're all there for different things. To your point that, you know, one person's there because they're looking for career development and somebody else is there because they just got the job last week and it's the only job they could find. And some other person is thinking about their family and everybody's got different objectives, different reasons for even being there. And so it makes it that much more challenging to create an environment where people are focused. So as you, I'm guessing, I could be wrong about this, but I'm guessing given your background and your personality, you're going to be a leader no matter where you are. You may be starting at Sway as an associate and in the role that you are, but it's hard to fathom that you're not eventually going to become, whether at Sway or somewhere else, that you're not going to eventually assume a leadership role in the civilian world. Do you think that's true or is that not necessarily true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you always have to be trying to work the person above you out of a job, and they should want that too. The bosses and the leaders should want that because, you know, if they're the linchpin and if they go away on a week vacation and everything, you know, falls apart, then they haven't done their job. You should be able to take that week vacation and things should keep churning as if you were there.
I think I don't know that that's necessarily the case for everybody wanting to be a leader. There are, I'll use this military term, even though I'm using it in a civilian sense, there are people who are good soldiers who don't want to be leaders, don't need to be leaders. They just want to play a role and do a great job. You know, they want to be people. I could think of people like this that I've had on my teams over my career who are as dependable as they can be. They're wonderful to have on your team. They are not interested in becoming a leader. They just want to play their role and do a fantastic job and know that, and have you know that you can count on them to play their role. I don't know that, at least from my perspective, that everybody aspires to be a leader, but those who are leaders like you usually do. It's hard to imagine not being a leader if you've been in that role.
Very true. And I think early on in my life, it was just kind of something that I fell into. And when there was something that needed to get done, I had no problem being the guy to try to coordinate that or owning up to it and taking responsibility for something. But then you're right, there's people that don't want that. And I have tons of friends in the SEAL teams that they just want to be a guy on the team and be really, really good at their job. You know, that's what makes this effective, because I, as the officer, am not the subject matter expert in each different thing. I have those guys in my enlisted guys on my team. They are the subject matter experts. They need to know that they're valued by me and that there is, like I said before, the mutual trust that when I come to them asking for something that relates to their subject matter expertise, like I'm getting the right answer. They know that I think that's the right answer as well, and that they're a valued contributing member of the team.
Yeah. You know, when you talk about trust, and it's such an important thing, I just coincidentally, I happened to be doing an interview earlier today where I was being interviewed, and we were talking about trust and the importance of trust in business relationships. Of course, it's important in all relationships, but we were specifically talking about business. And the interviewer was asking me about what are some of the behaviors that help to create trust between leaders and followers. And so I'm curious about on that question from your perspective. So how do you create trust? I mean, it's so important. What are the things you do to create trust in a relationship and between leaders and followers?
I think for me, it's just making that, and I don't want to sound like this to sound like it's forced, but it's making that emotional connection with others, showing that you genuinely have interest in them as a person, and whether it's work-related or home-related, you know, showing that you genuinely care about them as a person and value the time that you spend together. Because if you can't do that, then how are they going to open up to you in other ways and continue rolling that ball down the hill of like building trust? So I think that's probably the biggest thing for me.
Mm-hmm. It's just the personal investment in other people.
Yeah, the personal investment in other people and always trying to further develop that relationship.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to take this in a very different direction. This will require some vulnerability, so be careful about this question. So most people that have performed at a high level, whether it be, you know, in the military, whether it be a, you know, a superstar athlete, whether it be a musician who's, you know, a rock star, anybody who's performed at a high level, almost always, we've all had some degree of, I'll call it imposter syndrome, where, you know, at some stage of our life, we hoped we didn't get found out, that we didn't know what the heck we were talking about. I remember when I started in business, I was in my early 20s. So I started the day after I graduated college, and I was calling upon business owners. So here I am, a 22-year-old at the time, and I'm walking into small businesses, talking to CEOs, and hoping that they don't realize I don't know what the heck I'm talking about, and trying to fake my way through. And then I remember there was this time that, you know, years later, that I thought, hey, I actually do know what I'm talking about. Hey, this is kind of different. I'm no longer faking it. So as you think back over your career, whether it was, is, you know, playing lacrosse, or whether it was in the SEALs, or maybe even in civilian life, were there times that you think back where, you know, you worried that people would find out that you don't really know what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I first got to North Carolina, I thought, like, man, I come from South Jersey, which is typically not that big of a, or back then it wasn't a hotbed for pumping out Division I lacrosse players. I would always think to myself, am I even good enough to be on this team? Like, or is this just a mistake? Or was I just really good in South Jersey? And then you kind of have to block those things out and just do a little self-validation, like prove people wrong. And I think that's a big thing in my life, is just proving people wrong, or proving to myself that I do belong. And I was able to do that on the lacrosse field, you know, as a freshman starting for that team, just out of sheer will to want to prove it to myself that I did belong. And then in the SEAL teams, I didn't really have any imposter syndrome as far as like making it through buds. I think I just kept my head down and thought about my family and thought that, you know, I could never return home if I quit after I said I was going to do something. But when I did get to a SEAL team and I see all these other high performing, you know, junior officers that were there with me, I would always question myself, like, are you smart enough to lead all these guys? Are you capable enough to be in combat with these guys and make the right decisions on their behalf? Again, you just have to block it out and dedicate all your time to honing your craft of being that SEAL officer. So when the time does come, you have all the tools in the toolbox and you can, you know, pick from that menu and decide what the right thing to do is. And after that happens once, it's kind of like another validation point where, okay, yeah, I am good enough to do this. I think that it'll never really stop. It just, you get a little bit better at blocking out the imposter that pops up on your shoulder, knowing that you've blocked that out in the past.
Yeah. And I think some of that, just my own experience, some of that just comes with age and experience as well. Once you've done it enough, you realize, you know what? I know as much as anybody else knows here, or maybe more than these other people do. Some of that is probably a function of when you're younger or newer at anything, you see others who've been doing it for longer or are older and think that they have something that you don't have.
Yeah. And I think another important thing to think about is, like, anytime you go into a new role, anybody, it's going to be the first time that they're doing it. So there is a lot to learn. And the longer you're in that role, you become the subject matter expert of that role. And then you get promoted or something. And then yet again, you are fresh. You've never done that role before. And you have a lot to learn. So you start that cycle all over again. And it goes back to what you were just saying. Like, as you get older, you learn more, and you're constantly just evolving as a leader and a learner.
Yeah. So if we were to roll this picture forward and predict where you are, I don't know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, and I meet the Mike Burns CEO of some company down the road some. I hope you're a client of ours, by the way, by then. But I meet the Mike Burns CEO in the future, and I ask his employees, so what's Mike like as a leader? What would they tell me?
I would hope that they would say, you know, he's one of my best friends. And I know that's kind of contradictory to what I said very early on in this podcast, where I was trying to be like too much of a friend to people. But I think that what I've learned over time is, like, and as you get older and more mature, you can be someone's friend, but then also be very brutally honest. And people, as they get older, appreciate that more and more. And as a leader, it's so important for me to have that emotional connection with people and let them know that I can trust them and they can trust me, and think of it more as like an actual team environment versus, oh yeah, I work for this guy.
Mm-hmm. And so what would they, if I were to ask those same people, so how would you describe the culture of this company that Mike's the CEO of? What would they be saying?
I would hope that they would say, he thinks of all of us as equal, just with different job titles. And that's kind of how I thought about it, you know, towards the end of my time in the Navy, where, yeah, I'm the officer and I'm ultimately in charge of everything that happens here, but I'm really just a guy in the platoon with a different job than everybody else. The sniper is a guy with a job different from everybody else, and same with the breacher and et cetera. But we are all equal in that platoon. I just have a different role. And one of those roles is taking responsibility for good things and bad things that happen at the workplace.
Hmm. That's an interesting way to think of it, that yes, leaders are team members just like everybody else. They just have a different role than other people, not necessarily higher, lower, better, or worse, just it's a different role.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, you mentioned something interesting when you said that the leader is responsible for what happens to the team, good and bad. Can you think of a time, without revealing anything that's classified, of a time where things didn't go well and you as the leader of your team had to take responsibility for that?
Yeah, I have two ones that stick out in my mind because they were such learning points for me that I'll never forget. And going back to my first platoon chief, he was the one that helped me come to this realization. and I don't know if you've read any of Jocko Willink's books, but Extreme Ownership is kind of one that I really took to heart, and it's a good example of extreme ownership. And so we were on this kind of low key operation, nothing too crazy. it can always go awry, but one of the things that you need to travel with is a Blue Force tracker. And that's basically just like a little GPS thing. So the people sitting back at the command center know where you are. Mm-hmm. And through delegation, like, it was my communications guy's responsibility to put that in the vehicle, and he forgot to do it. And somebody called me on a local cell phone and said, "Hey, Mike, your Blue Force tracker isn't coming on. Can you just go turn it on?" I said, "Oh, my comms guy forgot to put it in the vehicle." My chief overheard me say that on the phone, and after I hung up, and he was just like, "Hey, your comms guy forgot to put that in the vehicle, or you as the leader forgot to check that all that stuff that needs to be done was done." And whether like I had to check mm-hmm. for it or not, it was the fact that like, that is my responsibility. I delegated it to him, and because it didn't happen, it falls on me. So I shouldn't be placing blame on other people for things that anything on that operation is my responsibility. So I need to own mm-hmm. up to it. And that's something that I absolutely never forget. The next one is kind of similar. We have these, kind of handheld drones that we fly. For whatever reason, they were crashing a lot. And it wasn't really a good look for multiple of these things to be crashing. And so another one crashed, and I thought to myself, "Oh my goodness, I really do not want to go back and report this." This was after the previous example happened. So for a moment, I thought, "I'm not the drone operator. I didn't crash this thing. I could report and say, oh yeah, our drone operator crashed another one. Or I could just say our unit or I crashed another drone and just, take it on the chin as the officer in charge." I thought back to the previous example, and ultimately it was just like, yeah, it's no one's fault but my own. These are my guys. This is my platoon. And I just got to own up to it. Mm-hmm. That first example has just followed me for the rest of my life. It's just so much easier to take responsibility for things than try to skirt around it and place blame on others, because then that deteriorates that trust that you work so hard to build up.
Yeah, and I'm sure the opposite is also true, that when you do take that ownership, if I'm a team member and I know, especially if I know I was the one that messed up, and I watch whether it's platoon leader, whether it's my boss, my CEO, whoever, I watch the leader take responsibility for something that I know I did. Boy, I'm really, I'm trusting that guy a lot.
Absolutely. Hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah. So Mike, this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you joining me. Some fascinating wisdom you've learned even at a relatively young age. But you've had some amazing experiences. So if our audience members wanted to, connect with you, I'm assuming is LinkedIn probably the best way to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. LinkedIn, I'm on that every day. So they can look up my handle there, which is Michael Burns 26, after the standard LinkedIn URL. And it's been great to be here. I certainly don't know everything, and I continue to try to learn every day and just get better as a leader and a human.
That's what makes you a great leader. Thanks again, Mike. Really appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mike. And that's it for this episode of Culture Architects. If you enjoy the show, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you automatically get my new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love it if you would leave us a review so more folks like yourself can discover the show. I'll see you next time.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Be sure to join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders from all walks of life. To book David for your events or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of Forbes Books.